Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. In this episode, I'm speaking to Erik Johansson about one of the most critical yet overlooked aspects of engineering leadership, cultural transformation. Get it wrong, and you'll see stagnation, resistance, and frustration. Get it right, and you unlock innovation, collaboration, and a high-performance engineering culture. I can't think of a more qualified person than Erik to bring you the real stories behind leading change, from overcoming resistance and blending work cultures after a merger to navigating imposter syndrome and building a culture of trust and innovation. Erik shares hard-earned lessons from his own journey, and we distill his years of experience into a practical playbook for CTOs looking to create meaningful change in their organizations. If you've ever struggled with getting teams to align, gaining buy-in for change, or ensuring a transformation actually sticks, stay tuned. I'm Adam Horner, and as a coach for CTOs, I help tech leaders break free from the constant firefighting cycle and develop the clarity, confidence, and leadership skills to excel in their roles. I provide hands-on, customized coaching that helps CTOs move from reactive decision-making to a more strategic, long-term approach. Whether it's improving delegation, aligning technology with business goals, or strengthening executive presence, my work is focused on empowering CTOs to lead more effectively. This podcast is an extension of that mission. By bringing in incredible guests and unpacking real-world playbooks, I aim to equip you with the strategies, insights, and practical tools you need to grow as a CTO and drive meaningful impact in your organization. Hi, Erik. Welcome to the show. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. We both know Zach Goldberg, who was a guest on the show previously, and I know who's somebody who values great engineering leadership. So I was really excited when he introduced us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I'm so happy to be here. It's amazing to join the ranks of the outstanding guests you've had on CTO Playbook.
Awesome. I mean, you've had a fascinating career, haven't you? Startups, multiple successful exits, co-author of C#. We can see that in the background behind you for those of you looking on YouTube, plus 3 sci-fi novels. And you umpire baseball. I mean, a father of triplets. How do you manage to fit it all in?
Well, you organize your life based on principles. You got to think about what's important in life, what you want to accomplish, and what you want to have done by the time everything is done. In one of my sci-fi novels, it features a president of the United States who gets an urgent message about China developing fusion on the same day he's out fishing with his son. And the son says, well, Dad, you have to go back to take care of that national security issue, right? And the president answers, well, that's important, but you know what else is important? Family. And of course, the president still goes on to help save the day in the novel. Finding that balance, making decisions based on first principle, helps you decide how to prioritize things. You know, family is a grounding force. Having triplets drives efficiency in daily life, I'll tell you that.
Absolutely. Yeah. As a father of 3, I can correlate a little bit. Not all born at the same time, but still, yeah, you do end up trying to make sure that you can blend work life and family life together rather than just balancing one off against the other all the time.
Absolutely.
You've been in the thick of engineering leadership, Erik, and today we're sort of diving into one of those most important but often overlooked topics, which is cultural transformation. And you know, I'd love to really understand from your experience, from your perspective, what is cultural transformation? What does it really mean? And why is it such a critical tool for us as CTOs?
Sure. Well, if you look at the dictionary definition, you'll get something like cultural transformation is about shifting the mindsets, behaviors, and communication patterns in an organization. But what does that really mean? If you look at the mindset, people tend to optimize for what they're scored on. If you rate people on something, they'll tend to want to be rated high, or they'll tend to optimize otherwise for their personal self-interests. And that's doubly true in organizations that don't encourage open communication and that don't encourage or power problem solving. Behaviors, well, that's emergent from the mindset. You can have anything from inefficient behaviors to undermining behaviors, depending on the organization. And what communication patterns? If you have closed communication, that leads to clicks, that leads to local optimization for problems, such as how to keep the ticket backlog small, even if that creates problems in other areas of the organization, such as customer satisfaction. Open communication leads to global optimizations. People participate in solving a larger problem if you allow them to. It's necessary to implement cultural transformation when the existing culture is misaligned with strategic goals. that causes inefficiency, it causes resistance to change. And if you just let culture happen, well, that tends to align with the personal interests of the most forceful personalities in the organization, and that will seldom be aligned with the company's interests and the company's needs.
That sort of management by the loudest decibel rarely ends up in going in the right direction, does it? So one of those challenges that we can all relate to, even if we've not consciously gone through a cultural transformation, are they? I mean, you've probably seen a lot of them through your career. Can you sort of share an early moment when you faced pushback while trying to lead change?
Sure. My first job after college was a mid-sized ERP company called AC Service, based in Munich, Germany. They had a strategic partnership with Hewlett Packard, and all of the products were based on the proprietary HP 3000 operating system. That was safe. It was very much in line with always buying IBM as a safe choice. But at that time, the open standards swing wasn't fully underway, and I saw the writing on the wall that proprietary operating systems meant limiting market share as more companies wanted to escape lock-in. And let me tell you, that was the first moment I really knew what imposter syndrome was. I was the top shot American, fresh out of college, trying to tell engineers with a decade or more invested in HP technology to pivot, and telling the business that their strategic choice for a proprietary partner was wrong. At that point, though, I hadn't learned humility. I covered up my insecurity with brashness. But the part I did do right was reduce the risk of change. I suggested a proof of concept to prove the process of migrating software to Unix, and right, I got it done in a week. In retrospect, I should have spent time talking to people about why they objected, listening. I ended up being right, but I steamrolled good people in the process, and I definitely learned from that experience.
So you managed to make the change, you got the evolution, but it wasn't necessarily, from a cultural perspective, the smoothest change. Interesting.
Yep.
So I've been through quite a few transformations now, and some that had a fairly significant cultural component, often when it's been in situations of high-speed growth of the company, of the team. And one thing I've seen firsthand is that leaders sort of underestimate the time and effort it needs to, well, really just make sure that things don't fall out of place, or assuming that everything will just fall into place. Have you seen that mistake play out? And if so, how do you avoid it these days?
Oh, absolutely. Cultural change can be sabotaged in so many ways. A common reason for corporate mergers to fail is a failure of the cultures to unify. Sabotage happens because of fear of change, desire for power, sometimes personal animosity if you upset the wrong people. They can end up talking in clicks behind your back. They can end up passively ignoring the change that you want to bring about. You might hear things like, I'm too busy right now, or we'll lose customer X if we make a risky change right now. And you can end up with a lot of inertia blocking the change that you want to see. And the way you overcome that is to spend a ton of time communicating why the change is needed and why the changes that you propose are the right ones. You do that by listening to people. You hear their concerns. Use your one-on-ones, talk to people there. Use your skip levels. Make sure you have skip levels to hear what's happening more in the organization. Or time with your peers in the organization. If you head up engineering, and you want to make sure the customer service is on board with things you want to change. You want to make sure finance is on board with things you want to change.
So it's well wider than just engineering then?
Oh, much wider than engineering. If you're changing the culture of a company, that impacts every function of the company, everything that happens anywhere in the company.
And does that give the CTO remit then in these cases, or is that just a case of collaboration and making sure that you work widely with the others to ensure that they understand the importance of the cultural migration that needs to happen?
Well, partly it's making sure that you get others to buy into understanding the importance, but partly you have to listen. You know, oftentimes you'll hear good ideas from other people that you didn't think of. You can not only incorporate that in your own strategy, but you can create a kind of inception where they see their ideas becoming part of the big picture, and you can take resistors and turn them around and turn them into allies.
That is where you end up getting this sort of gathered momentum towards a change in the right direction by having more and more allies around the business. So I've had a big challenge myself when I'm trying to do a migration. I ran a project where we needed developers to shift a mindset about test data rather than, you know, we need to build it all ourselves, getting to the point of understanding that the data needed to reflect actual real-world data rather than the extremes of the technically possible data. And I ended up taking a bunch of developers on a field trip, actually went to an airport, sat down behind some of the potential users of this kind of platform and watched them solve their day-to-day challenges that they come up against and the regular sort of jobs to be done. But, you know, in terms of that sort of flipping the switch and getting people to see things from a different perspective, have you had skeptical teams where you've sort of got them to turn around to sort of end up embracing the change you're suggesting after adversarial approach first?
I certainly have. You know, taking the team into the field and seeing how things done, I'm wholeheartedly in favor of that. Too many engineers are too isolated from the actual problem the customers face. And at Domo Financial, for example, we had a very high cost of delivering the service. It took a long time to solve problems. And the reason was the people who actually solved the problems weren't listened to. Right. They were treated like a function that had a well-defined input and a well-defined output. And the rest of management didn't care about the pain that happened in the process. And we sat down, looked at why it took a long time to address customer problems and what they were doing, where they spent the hours, and listened to them, incorporated their feedback in a plan to change how we communicate, to change how we deliver service. But I think most importantly, just made them know it's okay to speak up. Let them know that their voices are heard, their voices are valuable. And speaking up won't lead to punishment, it'll lead to better outcomes for everyone. And I help them take that information to the appropriate leaders to make decisions about how we optimize that department, which is not at all in engineering, but it needed to improve.
And that's an excellent point where you sort of, once you get to the point where you're able to start listening to people feel heard and then start being able to actually communicate more clearly when they've got the confidence that speaking up and speaking out is actually going to be heard, understood, interpreted, and acted upon, as opposed to just paid lip service to it, which oftentimes when you've got an adversarial cultural change, that's kind of the thing that happens. People just assume that they're hearing it to write it down on a piece of paper and then shove it in a bottom drawer and ignore it somewhere.
And that's the important thing. You need to build trust. You need to be consistent. You need to show people that when they speak up, it leads to change and it leads to improvement in the company, and it does not lead to negative repercussions for the individuals involved.
Hey, everyone. Quick question for you. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for my business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is record. They handle everything else. Editing, publishing, and making sure it's optimized perfectly for every platform. They're usually fully booked, but right now, I have a few spots open for new clients. As listeners of this show, you get 10% off launching your own podcast or optimizing your current one. All you need to do is follow the link in the description to book a free one-to-one podcast planning session with Podigy. Absolutely. Yeah, and on that note of sort of getting change and building trust, I mean, you sort of mentioned yourself a few times, you've been that engineer standing up to MBAs and execs who've got a decade or more of experience who, you know, their habit, their default position is to try and sort of play things safe. So where did you find the confidence from to push back when other people weren't necessarily being listened to, even though they had the right idea?
You know, I think it comes right back to my opening statement. It's about principles and what you want to do in this world. A lot of people play it safe. A lot of people are afraid to make waves. A lot of people don't stand up for other people when they're not being heard or when they're not being properly treated. I want to be remembered by everyone I've ever led as somebody who cares about them first and foremost, who wants to listen to them, who cares about the problem that the company is solving. And I never want to be remembered as somebody who's playing it safe, who's playing political games. So once you have your moral compass centered around, I want to do good in the world, I want to do good in the company, it's a lot easier to find the courage to speak up and see something wrong.
So it's conviction combined with principles, combined with a belief, basically.
Absolutely, but also combined with humility. You have to know that you're not always right. You may make mistakes. The first thing I do when I introduce myself to a new person in the workplace, whether it's the new CEO or a junior engineer, is say, you know, I make mistakes. I make multiple mistakes every day. It's okay. It's safe to speak up. I want to hear your point of view. You've seen and done things I've never seen and done before. And once you establish a relationship like that, it's a lot easier to build trust with those individuals.
And I think that's something that as you get more and more experience and you've made more mistakes, it becomes easier to admit you make mistakes. I remember thinking when I was early on in my career, thinking, I've got to do this perfectly. I've got to get this right first time. And that kind of pressure on myself felt immense.
Yeah, that's the imposter syndrome. When you're in a room doing something that you maybe never imagined yourself doing, or at least didn't imagine yourself doing this early in your career, it's easy to have self-doubt. And to some extent, self-doubt is important. If you're self-aware, it's good. It helps you measure when you're ready for something, when you're not ready for something. You know, we mentioned at the outset, I umpire baseball. I currently umpire high school baseball, which is a lot more than I ever thought I'd do when I stepped on the field and my kid first started playing Little League, you know, calling balls and strikes for the 10-year-olds. And just last week, I had the opportunity to umpire a Division I college baseball game. It's a preseason game, but those are players who are going to play professionally. Those are players who will be on TV during the regular season. And part of me was filled with, who am I? What am I doing here? But then there was the preparation for hours leading up to the game. I reviewed what's specific about the rules and mechanics for college umpire, made sure that I was as prepared as I reasonably could be. And then I reflected on the fact that umpired a lot. I've had fantastic mentors, and I just let myself be in the game and go do my thing umpiring. I stepped on the field, and from the first pitch, I was comfortable.
I love that. I mean, confidence isn't always easy. I mean, especially when you're sort of surrounded by insanely smart people or very capable and professional people, as you say. And that sort of, do I really belong here? It's a big moment. I mean, I, like you, I had some great mentors as well, helped me see my strengths. But in terms of the imposter syndrome, you mentioned a few things that got you through it there. But this is now with all of your experience. Early in your career, did you have the same approach, the same thoughts about it?
Early in my career, I screwed it up.
Do tell. It sounds like it's a fascinating story there.
You know, the part I was good at was understanding the technical aspect. I taught myself how to program from when I was about 14 years old. I always loved it. I was fascinated by understanding where technology is evolving to, how you can solve problems with it. But the whole interpersonal thing, I was not good at that. I mentioned a little bit earlier, I tended to be rude to people when I thought I knew better. I tended to steamroll people who I thought were in the way or sideline them. And it took some time and some maturity and some failure to see that knocking people along for the ride is not only bad for my objective, but it's also bad as a person. And that just took time to realize you need to listen to people, understand where they're at, understand what their objections are, both professional and psychological. A lot of things that happen in the business world are because people are insecure. They're insecure about their job, or they're insecure about how they're seen by the peers, or they just protect the job. Helping them overcome those objections of insecurity goes a long way to effective change.
And I think insecurity and trust are two things that kind of go hand in hand. One is almost the antidote for the other, isn't it?
You need to act consistently. If you say it's safe to bring things to you, it needs to be safe to bring things to you. It's great if you stand up for people in good times, but when you stand up for them in bad times, and there's maybe some risk to your own position, that starts to build trust. Be consistent. All of your actions should be based on principles and doing the right thing for the company, and doing the right thing by the people you lead.
Yeah, I always love one of the expressions of Michael Lopp, otherwise known as Rams, online. He always says, be unfailingly kind. It was something that I picked up from him when I was looking at Palantir. And it kind of holds true in almost all of these cases. If you keep that as a mantra, you're not going to go too far wrong with this, I think.
I have not heard that before, but I love it. It encapsulates everything nicely.
Thank you. And, you know, another thing about change, and especially when it comes to one of the trickiest parts of cultural change, is what I think of as being cultural integration, blending two different work cultures together. I mean, I worked on integration where there were two teams and we sort of deliberately kept them separate, working on separate streams, different offices, different approaches. And it led to a really slow adoption, integration, and mistrust sort of festered in the gap between these two teams. I mean, you've been through post-merger culture blending before. What have you learned about getting it right?
Well, we had the same challenge at Growflow where I first met Zach. Growflow was very much a Silicon Valley startup, move fast and break things, over-communicate, extreme ownership, all that good stuff. And you know, we had a culture where people could speak up, people were heard, you widely communicated everything that was going on. And then we were bought by essentially a fintech company called Domino Financial, run by people with a banking background. They had very hierarchical communication. They had a lot of what happened was based around power centers rather than open communication. Things were said, decisions were made, problems for address in private email chains. And sometimes you'd have a bunch of people CC'd on it, somebody else BCC'd on it. The person who actually knew the answer was added to CC at one point, but then people responded to the previous chain. It was the exact opposite of GrowFlow. And they had a lot of the problems you'd expect. Innovation was low, the cost of delivering service was high. There's a lot of distrust between departments. I was very fortunate that they brought in a new CEO who had an all-encompassing vision for both companies, saw the good in each, and he elevated me from VP of engineering responsible for the GrowFlow stuff to CTO of the whole company. And we partnered on cultural transformation. The worst thing I could have done is to go in and say, hey, look at GrowFlow. We're shipping quickly. Things are going great. You guys have to be the same, because no, they don't. You know, first of all, if you come in with that attitude, people will resist you. There'll be people who are my peers who say, no, that's not how we do it. But to some extent, they'd be right. You know, if you're building a cash reduce application, that's important. But if you're managing hundreds of millions, billions of dollars of people's money, moving fast and breaking things is not really a good idea. And it calls for a little bit of a different culture. So the open communication elements are super important. People being heard is super important. But some of the ideas about continuous integration, continuous delivery that make a lot of sense for that business don't necessarily, if you have some, you know, 7-year-old Java code that manages a lot of money. So a lot of that was about listening to people and finding some of the valid reasons for why some of the things were the way that they were, but also encouraging them to understand where GrowFlow was coming from and some of the things that really worked well. And in the end, we were able to balance the cultures. That the best moment, and this is one where I shared this with Zach, who was the former CTO of GrowFlow that subsequently had left by this point. When I shared this moment with him, he just laughed out loud. One of the staunchest resistors to over-communication as a company value was in an executive meeting and said, we really need more over-communication in this company. Well, yes, that's when you know you've done things right. And we went on to not only stop burning money, but break even. And late last year, we successfully exited the company by selling to one of the big players in the space.
That's really the testament to a big transformation when you get to the results, the outcome that you're actually going for. Brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the times on the way, it's not just about leadership, listening to individuals. I think when you've got that many people, you mentioned multiple departments, is getting them to listen to each other as well.
Yes. One leader will not solve everything. You need to build environments where individuals are maximally empowered to solve problems in their domain and to communicate with their peers in other domains to work out solutions between them. If you're the bottleneck, you're limiting the organization's bandwidth. If you create an organization that's trust-based, where people are empowered to not only do their job, but to execute the overall mission of the company, you have so much more leverage.
Absolutely. Yes. And that trust, leverage, it all goes together and works brilliantly. But Eric, I've got to ask you, before we get into sort of talking about some of the methods, the playbook, the solutions, Eric, what's the biggest mistake you've ever made in a cultural transformation?
Just being brash, not listening, not slowing down, not talking to people. And you know, the fact that I was right, not once, but twice early on with that level of brashness, I'm actually kind of surprised that I was able to overcome that and learn to listen to people. anybody who's young in their career, or maybe is older in the career, but still thinks they're always right. I think you should learn from this and can learn from this. Don't be mean. Don't be that guy who steamrolls people. Don't be that guy who pushes things through. Be the guy who listens to the organization, talks to the organization, not only brings them on board with what I'm trying to accomplish, but encourages them to try to accomplish similar things in their domain.
One of the reasons I asked that question is because I love one of the quotes by Bill Gates, where he says that success doesn't actually teach you an awful lot. He was very successful early in his career, and he said that success doesn't teach nearly so much as getting it wrong. What he said was that, you know, great decisions come from experience. Experience comes from getting it wrong.
Yes, exactly.
So let's now sort of break down the practical and repeatable strategies that you've got for leading cultural transformations, especially from the technical perspective. And for a CTO listening today, where should they start? What's the first thing they need to get right?
Well, the first thing you need to get right is understanding if there actually is a problem. Sometimes you have a way of doing things and you go into a new company and you think, this is different. I must be wrong. Sometimes there's a lot of right ways to do things. There's plenty of wrong ways, but there's a lot of right ways. Make sure there's a real problem before you decide you need to change something. And then be specific. What actually is the problem? What specific elements of the culture are causing what specific problems. You'll need that not only to know that you're doing the right thing, but also to understand how to address it, what to talk to people about, what questions to ask.
Cool. And I think once you understand that, then you end up with looking at objections, right? So it's then looking at bringing people onto the journey. So how do we get people on the journey and try not to sort of sideline or alienate others in the process?
Well, first of all, look for the people who long for change. They're there in any organization. Those people who have been frustrated by the current leadership, see the problems, just haven't felt empowered. Identify those people because they're your easiest allies. Listen to their ideas about what change looks like. Then you'll find a bunch of people who are kind of frustrated by the status quo. They kind of feel that maybe it could be better, but they either don't understand there's a better way or they don't believe there's a better way. Share your ideas about how things can be different with them and get them to think about becoming part of the solution that you're angling for.
Absolutely. Cool. And then a lot of the thing you talked about earlier on was over-communication. I mean, you mentioned that several times. And then the other thing is safety, normally expressed as psychological safety. And one of the things I've figured out over time, at least I think I have, is that how you communicate change matters just as much as what it is that you're going to change. When it comes to that, what's the sort of the key tenets of building that culture of psychological safety and over-communication, as you said?
Well, you know, the first step is to be humble in everything you do. I establish my relationships by letting people know I'm not always right, and that empowers them to call me out when I'm wrong. And it lets them know that I'm not one to try to force things, but that I am one to listen to others, hear their objections, hear what they think should be done differently. I encourage people who are naturally shy to speak up in meetings. Sometimes the quietest voices have the best insight into what's going on. Find opportunities for the shyer people to speak up in meetings. It builds credibility, especially in that person's peer group who might know that they're very smart, but just don't necessarily speak up. You got to share the good news, of course, but share the bad news equally. Be transparent about what the company does right, what it does wrong. Lead over communication by example. You know, share the things that many companies might not want the employees to hear. And lastly, when bad things happen, work the problem. Don't blame people. Sometimes, you know, you'll find an employee who repeatedly does the wrong thing. And that's a subject for one-on-one discussions. But in general, focus the entire organization on problem solving and reject any attempt to blame anybody in the moment.
Yeah, I always go with the mantra of trying to fix the process, not the person.
Yes.
And, you know, I think the other thing is that actually on its own, fixing the process, not the person, the temptation is often to look at the person. And it's an unbelievably tempting approach. But it's one example of just change being hard. And, you know, being able to see that as you're going through this tough stuff, making personal changes, making team changes, that we're actually getting somewhere. So what's your advice on two things, I think, really, I'm looking for? One is, how do we show some sort of progress? And the other one is, how do we embed the changes we've made so they stick and don't sort of regress back to old behaviors?
So showing the progress is, I love to show metrics. One of the indicators that the process is wrong is the metrics bad, you know, whether the sales are low or whether you're failing to meet the SLA metrics or whether the NPS scores are low. You want to modify process to drive better outcomes of the things you measure that are important to indicate whether the business is healthy or not. Show them transparently whether they go up, whether they go down. Show people what impact we're having. If the metrics continue to go down, you have to be humble and think maybe you've done something wrong. And maybe the approach you're taking or the path you're taking the company on isn't the best one. But in my experience, they go up. When you do the right things and you place trust in people, the tangible measurements of business success almost always go up. Encourage feedback from anyone in the company and make that feedback public. Allow people from any department, anywhere in the company to publicly share ideas and make sure you act on them.
One of the organizations I worked with used a sort of anonymous approach to feedback, allowing people to give like almost like a whistleblower channel through which they could deliver anonymous feedback. And we found that that helped people come forward when otherwise they might have thought they would be judged for coming forward. Have you used that technique at all?
I understand the place it has. I've never formulated it specifically as a whistleblower or a private feedback or suggestion box kind of thing. I think that's a hallmark of a company that has some health issues. People don't feel that they can speak up. But I do that informally. I'll talk with people saying, you know, we have these meetings on Monday and Friday where you can speak up, get out there, let the company know what your opinions are. But if you're shy about it, talk to me. My door is always open. We have one-on-ones. Or if you're not in one of my direct reports, just put some time in my calendar and let's talk. So I've always done that more of an informal thing when I've seen, in particular, I've seen people that I recognize as being shy or hesitant.
Yeah. No, I've worked with one particular organization. You're quite right. When you talk about that organization I was in, there was something quite broken at that stage. I would end up in meetings with people talking to me, knowing that my title was CTO, and then blaming things on management. If management decide this, then we'll do it. And I'm sitting there thinking, but that's me. I'm right here.
That's me.
Exactly. So I think in that case, the anonymous tip box helped us get over that stage of, you know, we are management, we are listening, and we'll bring all the ideas come forward no matter where they came from.
So I totally agree. There's a time and place for that. I've just not been in that time and place personally.
Yeah. No, cool. Okay. What I'd love to try and do, because you sort of defined at the beginning about cultural change being a shift in principles, behaviors, and the communications that go with it. So if we try and distill all the good stuff you come through into a playbook, let me know if I miss anything out here, but as we go along.
Sure.
But I think the first stage is to identify what it is that you actually need to change. And then from there, also look at the specific objections and address those too. To balance, and this is a tricky one, to balance the confidence with the humility to make sure that you build trust, essentially, rather than losing people either on one side where they sort of have no faith in you, or on the other side where they don't believe you're going to change anything.
Yeah.
Number three, which is kind of hopefully an outcome of the first one, is bring people along on the journey. And I think really that's a case of not leaving anybody behind to make sure that cultural transformation affects everybody along the way.
Right.
We had understanding and adapting to the differences that you find in culture around the place. So you don't just steamroller one or the other, that you try and bring all of them together. Number five, we had to blend the different work cultures together and do that in a way that's thoughtful, that's smart, that's integrated, and that is compassionate. Number six, you just mentioned that actually as well, which is sort of metrics-driven accountability, so we can see who or what is driving which numbers. Number seven, over-communicate and make information accessible. Preferably not via anonymous Dropbox, but if you have to, then that's a way of starting.
It'd be the culture where it's at, but yes, it's the more transparent, the more open you can be, the better it'll be.
Yeah, definitely. And I think on that note is number eight, it's building a culture of psychological safety where people can be open, where people feel safe to bring up issues and talk about them. Number nine on my list I had was to celebrate the small wins and the shifts that succeed so that you help them get to the point where they're stuck and stay there.
Yep.
And then number 10, sort of distilled out of what you'd said, which was to manage the risk and try and do that without stifling the creativity or stifling the innovation that comes out of it.
That's a fantastic summary.
Thank you. Did we miss anything out? Or does that encompass basically all we need to do to make a really good cultural transformation?
If you can do those things, that'd be great.
So if then I was to get you to give a CTO tip, one thing that they had to take away about cultural transformation, what would it be?
I'm going to cheat a little bit with the conjunction, but I'd say care about the people you lead and be humble.
It's a very good tip, I think, pretty much in all scenarios. Eric, it's been an incredible conversation. If somebody wants to get in touch with you, to connect with you, or to find out what else you've got going on, where's the best place to find you?
Well, my personal website is just my last name, johansson.us. And I have all my contact information on there, along with some information about the books I've written.
Excellent. And we'll have that link in the show notes so people can follow it from there. And thanks, Eric. It's been absolutely fantastic. And for everyone listening as well, if you found today's episode valuable, please visit our website to join the CTO Playbook community for more insights and resources. The link will be in the show notes. See you in the next episode. And until then, keep leading with impact. Thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you, Adam. Have a good day.
Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.